Unmute.
But she hasn't said yes yet.
The Pacific yeah. Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meeting. Good evening. My name's Becky, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note, you will be given a 5-minute and 1-minute reminders when it is time for you to wrap up your talk. Our first minute speaker, Robert C.
Good evening. My name is Robert and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Robert.
I would like to welcome all of you into my living room this evening. You're very welcome here. First of all, I'd like to thank Marty for asking me to speak this evening. I feel like I'm a very, very blessed guy just to be sober. I really am. If we have any newcomers, I would like to welcome you, and I'd love to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I certainly hope you will find here what I found. I found myself a brand new life. I had no idea I even wanted this life. In fact, I didn't know what this life was all about, but it is a good deal, you know. First of all, you know, I was born and raised in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, you know, and none of my parents drank, neither one of them. There was no alcohol in my home. I didn't start drinking until kind of late. The first drink I remember taking was my senior year in high school when I graduated from high school. And, you know, I'd always been a little bit shy about talking to girls and that sort of thing. And I remember taking a big swig of that wine at night. And man, I was a man that night. I walked into that room and I started dancing and I started talking to nothing but girls. Didn't want to have nothing to do with the guys, you know, and that alcohol was talking to me, you know, but I didn't shoot off and become an alcoholic then, you know. I had no idea there was a big difference the way alcohol reacted for me. You know, I ended up going to college for a few years and got drafted into the military, and I suppose that's when my drinking started escalated, was in the military, because where I was really scared to death when I was there. So what I know today is that drinking alcohol removed that fear. Drinking alcohol allowed me to dance with those girls. And, you know, I don't know if I made a mental note of that or not, but I do know anytime I was in a social situation or a scary situation, I remember I would drink. You know, ended up getting married before I went to Vietnam. I had a couple of children, you know, a little boy and a little girl. You know, my son, as a matter of fact, Demetrius, is a member of the this program now. You know, it took him a long time, but now he's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm really happy about that. You know, I'll tell you, when I started drinking, everything was fine. I had a wonderful time. My life was good. I had a lot of fun. I had no fear of things. But all of a sudden, the thing that happened to me is it seemed the alcohol changed. You know, alcohol stopped working for me. And what I mean when I say alcohol stopped working for me, it no longer removed that fear that I had. It no longer gave me the confidence to speak with people. In fact, what it did just the total opposite for me. You know, it became so bad until I couldn't look at anybody in the face. I didn't want you to look at me, because I was afraid if you looked at me and I looked at you, you could see right through me. You could see that I'm nothing. I'm dirt. I shouldn't even be here, and you wouldn't like me. You know, I'd be walking down the street, and if I was approaching, I'd step to the side and just drop my head. You know, I just didn't want to see you, and I didn't want you to see me. I spent a lot of nights and days in my car, sleeping. I'd wake up. I didn't know if it was morning. I didn't know if it was evening. But it really didn't matter because I really had no place to go whatsoever, you know. But I was very, very fortunate. I know one thing that I did do, even during my drinking, because of the way that I was raised, I believed in a higher power. And even during that time, I would pray. I used to call my parents every now and then and really upset them because they were in Arkansas and I'm living out here. And I just asked them if they would just pray for me. Things were not going well for me. And I know my parents would crawl out of the bed and get on their knees and help me to get on my knees wherever I was. And they would pray for me. You know, I know for a fact that prayer does work. And I'm sure that is why I'm here with you today. You know, I ran across this guy who was a veteran and he suggested that I go to the VA hospital. He said they have an excellent program for people like you, he said. And I really didn't want to go to the VA. Here I was with no place to live, not taking a bath or anything. You know, I said, no, I don't want to go to the VA. It's just a bunch of drones over there. But I got to tell you, I am so grateful that that VA accepted me. You know, I walked into that VA and they gave me a nice clean bed to sleep in. And I could get a nice shower. They gave me food to eat. They gave me clothes to wear. And I think one of the most important things that the VA hospital did for me is they brought me to you, you know, and I was happy to get to you. You have always, always been very, very kind to me. Even though I was feeling the way that I was feeling, you were very kind. You were very friendly and you welcomed me into Alcoholics Anonymous. You told me to get a sponsor and I did get a sponsor. By the way, my sponsor now, his name is Paul C. And he's helping me out a lot. But you told me about a sponsor. I got a sponsor, and people in AA have been nothing but kind to me. And when I first came to you, I had no car. I lived in one direction. You lived in the other. I would walk to the bus stop, and you would just absolutely insist on giving me a ride home. You didn't know me, but you would give me a ride home. You know, you gave to me, and I hope I will be able to give back the same way. You know, like I said, that job, I had lost that job that I've had for about 12 years, and I had no idea what I was going to do for a living, but my sponsor then was Frank Jones. Frank told me to just go out there and get myself a job. You know, he said he doesn't care what kind of job it is, and I went and got myself a job as a security officer, and I got to be honest, I only had a little time, but I thought, man, that job's beneath me because I was the man, you know. But I worked that job, and I got to tell you, that's the best job I've ever had right there. That job paid me $4.50 an hour. But what I learned about that, what you taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that $4.50 an hour certainly is a lot better than no dollars an hour. That job provided me with everything I needed, you know, and I was able to go back to school and get and start working electronics, you know. And everything that is good for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have gotten out of Alcoholics Anonymous. There have been some bad things that's happened. Yeah, I've gotten divorced in sobriety. You know, I lost my mother in sobriety. I lost my father in sobriety. Because of you, I got a chance to be in the room with my father when he breathed his last breath. I was there with him because of you, you know, and he knew that I was there, you know, but I got to tell you, my dad had a nice long life. He was 100 years old when he passed, you know, but I've got a relationship with my children. I have a relationship with my grandchildren. I have 13 grandchildren. I'm a very, very proud grandfather. You know, I love them to death, you know, and I could have missed all of this. I could have still been out there on the street. It would have been my luck to be out there on the street wishing I would die and continue to live. But my life is good, and it's only good because of what you gave me in Alcoholics Anonymous, these 12 steps. And I do work them to the very best of my ability. And I am so, so grateful that I'm sober. I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you're new and you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, it does not mean that your life is over. Your life is just beginning. That's what happened to me. I came to AA and my life started then. You know, I'm not sure where I am on time. But I do know, I just want you to know, newcomer, this program works, and it works very, very well. All you need to do is just keep coming back. I'd like to tell my favorite little joke at the end of this, kind of represents the time I was drinking. I had no idea why I was drinking. These two little boys lived next door to me. One was 5 years old, and one was 7 years old, a 7 year old told a little 5 year old brother, you know, I think we ought to start cussing. 5 year old goes, okay. 7 year old go, I'm gonna use the word hell, you use the word fat ass. This little brother go, okay. Next morning went down to breakfast, mother asked the 7 year old, so what would you like for breakfast this morning? He scratches it, he thinks, oh hell, give me a bowl of Cheerios. She looks at him, she doesn't like this. And she throws him out of throws him into his room, slams the door behind him. And then she looks at the 5 year old and says, so honey, what would you like for breakfast? He said, I don't know either, but you can bet your fat ass I don't want no Cheerios. So if you're new, please coming back. Again, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Robert. And our second 10-minute speaker is April S.
Hi, everybody. April S., alcoholic. Thank you, Marty, for asking me to share. It is an honor to speak in front of my home group. And I want to give a shout out to my sponsor, Linda Loyson, and my sober sisters. And so here I am. It's Wednesday night, and I'm really happy to be sober today, especially during this pandemic when I'm not embarrassing myself on video and drunk in stupors. But let's see, my sobriety date is March 26, 2013. I have a little over 7 years of sobriety, and I got sober when I was 45 years old and I started drinking as a kid. So I drank for a really, really long time. Alcohol is my drug of choice, even though I tried other things. Those other things are illegal and hard to get, and it never gave me the magic that alcohol gave me. So I started drinking when I was young. I came from a family, a very normal, good quality family that enjoyed family parties and poker. And so we would all get together and the kids just started sneaking the alcohol and having fun in the background. The parents weren't paying attention to us at all, and we just had a really good time. But what was happening is all of me and my brother and all of my cousins, by the way, we all ended up with alcoholism, every one of us. And we just, the green light was on when we were drinking. There was none of us that had any kind of reservations about our drinking. So it was a lot of fun. It's so funny, I have these messages coming in. Anyway, but I only have 8 minutes left. So we were all drinking as kids, and what I thought was an alcoholic was my brother. He had a problem with blacking out all the time and getting sick, and I thought that he had a problem with drinking. But for me, drinking through as a kid and through high school and everything was more of like a party. It was fun. It was something we all did. And I drank and drove all the time, and back in the 80s, we were let go. I never got arrested back then. So the kind of consequences that you would expect for somebody that is a problem drinker, that's what I always thought, people that went to AA had a problem with drinking. And I actually never once thought that I had a problem with drinking, and that continued until I got sober. So, sorry, my voice is cracking. So anyway, I grew, when I was young, I was in San Jose, and then I got a job in Los Angeles and I moved out here, and my job was in the music industry, and I got to go to clubs, and I abused that job, and I got fired because of my drinking, because of my partying. And then I moved on, and I found, I got married to a guy who drank like I did. He was very sophisticated, and I enjoyed that. And I was trying to have a decent lifestyle. And so I kind of attached myself to him, and we were together for 20 years. And during that time, we just had this life of delusion, basically, but I'll talk about myself only. And I just drank every day, and I woke up every single day with a hangover, and went to work hungover, drank at lunch, went back to work, finished my work, and then drank after work. And then, you know, went home and drank myself until I passed out. And I literally did that for a couple of decades. So what happened was we had relocated to Lake Tahoe. It was definitely a geographic. And My father was ill out there, so we went out there. And out there, it was a small town, and I was horribly uncomfortable in my own skin. I couldn't perform at work, and I lost that job too. And I was drinking 24/7. You know, my nervous system was shutting down. I was getting super skinny. My muscles were getting atrophied. And I was sick, but I still had no idea this was the alcohol, that alcoholism was causing my problem. But anyway, I passed out on a bar stool, just sitting there drinking, passed out. And that was a solid blackout. I didn't remember any of it. I still don't. I was told about it the next morning. And it scared me a lot. And I was talking to my brother, and he wanted to get sober. He asked me to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with him. And I said, sure. And so we went together, and that was March 26, 2013. I haven't had a drink since. And that is solely because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, that is, I would be drinking today if I was not an active member in AA. Thank you. I, at that time, I got a sponsor right away. Everybody was saying to get a sponsor, and I was so annoyed about that, that I got a sponsor just so people would stop bugging me about it. And she was 5 years sober at the time and taking a birthday cake. And, you know, this was a little tiny meeting that I got sober in. It was a participation meeting, and I managed to put together 90 days, and they made me secretary. And I thought that, you know, I was really important. And so I would bring donuts to the meeting to get people to show up and all these little tricks. But actually, that secretary commitment, actually, it's, again, it's a little tiny meeting, but it really got me into the middle of that group right there. But in time, I decided to move back to Los Angeles. And when I moved back, I was feeling really, really lonely. I was having a hard time connecting with the meetings, and what I was doing was bouncing around, and I hadn't found a new sponsor yet. And I was just kind of going to whatever meeting I felt like going at the time. And then I started to get exposed to the Pacific group. And what I was getting really, really sick at this time, spiritually sick. I had 3 years of sobriety. I was starting to hallucinate. I had, you know, sober hallucinating. And I, so then I went to Wednesday night and told a good friend of mine, Logan, that I needed a sponsor, and I was desperate, and I was having a really hard time. And he led me to my sponsor, Linda L., and she got me into the Big Book the next day. And we just, she started to bring me back to life. We went through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It took me about a year and a half. I gave it everything I had, and I made all of my amends. I had a spiritual awakening. It was obvious. For me, it wasn't just a shift in perception, but I had spent my entire life feeling tightly wound, and that tightness actually started to release the same way that it would after I had several drinks at the bar. And so, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has been working for me. I now chase that. I have a connection with my higher power, and I chase that the way that I chased a drink before, because I don't like to feel uncomfortable at all. And that's why I always had alcohol there for me. And so instead of, you know, drinking today, the obsession got lifted in 2017. I could tell you about that. Actually, we have a participation meeting in Westchester on Monday nights, and somebody was sharing about 4th of July week. And I noticed right then that I wasn't thinking about alcohol at all that holiday. And that had never happened to me. I was always thinking about drinking, no matter where I went. I was thinking about why I can't drink. What are you drinking? Why aren't you drinking enough? Why, you know, just everything. And I had no thoughts. And that actually has not, I have a little thought here and there, but it's not an obsession anymore. I completely got lifted. And when people would say that from the podium, I would think that they were lying. I thought that they did not drink like I did, because I was a real alcoholic and I always thought about drinking. But it's true. If you're new, the obsession does get lifted. It was as direct result as working the from working the 12 steps, staying in the middle of AA, being part of a really strong home group, having a great sponsor. And today I have, thank you. I've got 1 minute left. So today I live a really good life. I carry the principles I have learned in the program out to my relationships outside of AA, my working relationships. I had a really bad cycle before working the 12 steps where I would start a job and quit and start a job and quit and start a job and quit. I just kept doing that over and over and over. And now I have a great job. I'm staying with the job. I can always get a good job, but I never sustained it. And so, you know, I'm not out drinking. And then we were in the pandemic and I'm not on video embarrassing myself and calling people all the time. This is a huge gift. So if you're new, I really hope you stick around and you're part of a great group right now. And I look forward to seeing all of you guys in person again. I miss all of you. I love you so much. And thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, April. Speaker tonight is Tom W.
Work. Hi, I'm Tom, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
Waving at you from Oakland, California. I lived in LA 100 years ago, and so I'm sure I know some of the folks in the group. Hello. My sponsor lives down there, ever so far from here, and on March 15th, I had the chance to visit with him a little bit. He lives in central LA. His name is Father Terry, and he's in his early 80s, and he's in wonderful emotional and psychological health. As some of you know, he's not well. He has dementia, and the short-term memory is very, very problematic, to be polite. But his kindness and his sobriety and his friendliness is very apparent. So then I came home, I drove home, and we've been in lockdown ever since. So I'm a little bit stir crazy, but not dangerous. And I'm glad for the Zoom. One of my friends who lives just a little further away from here, about 3 miles, does not like the idea of Zoom. And so he refuses to Zoom. And he is more unhappy than most of us are, just so you know. I was at a meeting in Fresno in early March, and they have a weekly or a yearly thing called Bring Your Sponsor to Dinner fundraiser for the central office. And I met some old timers in Fresno, and they had been around since the 1950s. And somewhere in the middle of the 1950s, there was a big discussion in Fresno about whether the central office there should buy a telephone or not. Because real AA is done by letter, and they write New York, and then so they had to discuss it for 6 months because that's how we do things, and they finally decided to buy a phone. So the world changed. What I notice here with the lockdown and the quarantine, within 10 days, Alameda County was all up on all meetings were Zoom meetings. So technological, clever people, and I'm sure a bunch of 11-year-olds figured that out and makes it all accessible. So hello, and I'm glad to share experience, strength, and hope with you for about 35 minutes. On Saturday, this past Saturday, I celebrated 16,000 days sober. So this is what, 16,003 or 4. So that's over 40 years, and I find that extraordinary. And I got sober when I was 29 years old. I think you're supposed to talk about drinking a little bit in an AA meeting. So I grew up in San Jose, joined the Jesuit community when I was 18, lived up here a little bit, then moved to Los Angeles to go to school for 2 years out at Loyola Marymount in Westchester. And I wasn't drunk there a lot, but I was drunk out there. And I remember, this is 1970, No, 1967, 1968. It's so long ago and far away. And they were trying to civilize us. We were a bunch of young guys. They were trying to civilize us. And one of the things they wanted to do was to teach us how to drink. This wasn't a class, but it was a class. And Sunday evenings, they would have us gather, all in full cassock, all wearing very, very black things. And they'd present sherry in sherry glasses with fruit. I mean, this is, please. And I had been exposed to alcohol before, and I had blackouts in high school and the changes in personality, and I was a drunk driver at 17, so I had some exposure to alcohol. But I remember these stupid little sherry glasses, and it's very sweet. And I don't understand sherry world, and I really don't understand mixed drink world all that well. But I remember you take one of those cute little sherry guys and slam it down, and then take a second one and slam it down, and then you could go more slowly with number three. But I don't think that's what they were trying to teach us. It just seems silly to me. And then I did more schooling and more schooling and more schooling, and I ended up teaching high school kids at Loyola High School in Los Angeles, which I loved. It was my first job. And I love being in the classroom. I taught history. There were all these kids, and I was in my early 20s and full of energy. And I really enjoyed everything about it. And I can tell you this, I never discovered the morning drink. No one explained that one to me. But afternoons and evenings, alcohol pretty much every day. I'm one of those daily drinker persons. And there were times I would show up in the classroom extremely very hungover. And I just thought that was pretty normal. I mean, I didn't question any of my behavior. And I remember, so this is, I'm 26, 27 years old, the shaking hand. And I remember being in the classroom with my hand shaking like this with a coffee cup. And I really thought that meant that I was a very sensitive person who was overworked. That's how I understood it. And so it didn't bother me. And then, of course, you have a cigarette. I had a lot of bad behavior. A couple years pass. I get sober. I get sober in 1976, so it's the brief Ford presidency. One of the kids I taught came to visit. He'd been graduated. I think maybe he'd even did some Peace Corps stuff. Anyway, he comes to Berkeley to visit me, and I'm sober a couple of months. And we talked a little bit. His name was Eric. He was one of the nice boys that didn't get into trouble, so I didn't really pay that much attention. I liked the kids that got into trouble. But there was this nice boy named Eric. And we talked a little bit, and then he said, "You're really different." And I said, "How am I different?" And he said, "Well, we've been sitting down talking for about 20 minutes, half an hour. And the last time I saw you a couple years ago, you could never sit still. You were always around." And he said, "And you shook a lot. And you were," he said, "you're not shaking anymore." But it was, I think if I had that morning drink, I wouldn't have shooken, geschockt. So one of the men who mentored me was a physician up here named Dr. Gil Iott. Gil, French-Canadian, and grew up during Prohibition in the United States. He was an old guy, but he remembers Americans going into Canada to buy booze and get drunk, and you know, how great is that? So he wanted to move to the United States, and he did move here, and he came to San Francisco, started his family medical practice, and he gets sober late Eisenhower years, and he met Bill Wilson. And Gil spends the rest of his life as a physician helping people get well. I mean, he worked at treatment centers, and he helped some priests get well. And he was one of the guys we'd call on when someone was in real trouble. And he was a gracious, man with a French accent. I mean, what's not to like? But he developed blindness, macular degeneration, and couldn't drive. And so some of us younger guys, younger by 10, 20, 30 years, would drive him around because he'd speak at meetings. And I was with him when he gave a series of talks for a room full of doctors and nurses and therapists on alcoholism. And that's a tough crowd to talk to. But he was talking as an alcoholic, and he discussed the progression of the disease. And he said, you know, first it's fun, and then it's fun plus problems, and then it's problems. And I heard someone, I've been Alameda County, I'm in Oakland, and Marin County is over there, and we never go there. But I was there one night, and a fellow was talking about loving Dr. Gill and spending some time. And what he heard Gill say was fun plus trouble. And troubles and problems, there's a little nuance different, but that's pretty good. The first step, asked if you're still having any fun. You know, are you still having any fun? If you're still having fun with your drinking, you're not going to find us interesting at all. If you have the gift of desperation, spending time Zoom or in a room with a bunch of women and men in recovery is a pretty good experience. So, you know, as I explain, I get a lot of phone calls because, you know, this is not a program for people who need it. It's a program for people who want it. And a lot of people need us. But we're glad to be here. I heard my sponsor. I listened to my sponsor. I watched my sponsor years ago. And there was a young man who, brand new, and Terry talked. Terry did a lot of talking around, as lots of you know. And Terry has an odd kind of humor and is kind of dry and British. And if you don't pay attention, he's not that funny, but he's really very funny. But people laughed as he shared, and people laughed as he talked because it was that recognition. And this guy was very upset by the laughter. How can you laugh about this tragic disease? Well, you know, recovery has started when you can start laughing at yourself. Identification and acknowledging, and someone describes crazy behavior, and you know that crazy behavior. So then this young man said, Terry, are you surprised to be sober? And Terry says, no, I'm not surprised to be sober. I've been sober a couple of times. Terry's a periodic. I'm a daily drinker. He was a periodic. He said, what I'm surprised is I'm so happy to be sober. I like being sober. This is not unspeakable deprivation. This is a really good way to live. And that's a lot of my experience. I mean, 16,000 days, zowie. And today's okay. I mean, I'm in my 74th year. So I've been doing this for a while. And I taught school. Anyway, let me get back to, so drinking in Berkeley. I get sober in 1976 because I'm intervened on. My first thought when I'm in trouble is to ask for help. I don't want anybody to know anything about any difficulty I'm having. You bluff your way through. Facade is everything. How are you? You lie, and you don't even know you're lying. And you tell this person a little bit and this person a little bit. And that. So I did that for years and years and years. I had developed some very effective ways of dissembling and deflecting and changing the subject. I was a great let's change the subject person. But I was a couple of classmates of mine, one of whom died of our disease and the other is sober today, contacted the new boss And I was the new boss's first alcoholic, and we had that conversation, and I went into treatment to an AA-friendly place here in Berkeley. And I got out of treatment on a Friday and began my third year of studies on Monday. And boy, it was, I went to a lot of meetings my first year because I felt, well, I was feeling, you know, this is a crisis. I mean, for my first 2 or 3 years sober, I think I presumed I was in crisis because I was having feelings. And it took a while to sort that out, that having feelings is a good thing, and they come and they go, and learning what fear actually feels like. I was afraid of a lot of things, but I never noticed. I was more in touch with being angry all the time. And even that I deny, you know, I'm not angry, I'm telling the truth, that kind of thing. But a lot of anger, a lot of fear, a lot of shame, a lot of self-loathing. And alcohol sedates all that most of the time. So when I wasn't drinking anymore, all that stuff began coming up. And it did not come up politely, and it did not come up in nice, neat packages. So I really needed meetings. Meetings took the edge off. Up here in the East Bay, a lot of meetings started at 8:30 and they were over at 10. Hour and a half meetings, kind of speaker, round robin discussion seemed to be the thing. Someone would talk a little bit, then we'd discuss. And we didn't do the big speaker meetings very much. So it was kind of radically democratic. And I liked that. That's how I got sober. And a lot of people were depressed, and a lot of us were in graduate school. And a lot of us had therapists, and we quote our therapists, and the rooms weren't well lit. But young people were at meetings. I was 29, and in the mid-70s, there were a lot of women and men in their mid-20s and mid-30s getting sober, some even younger, but I didn't feel like a freak. And I was sober, got sober in August. In the spring, they were having an AA Young People's Convention in Monterey, which is 2 hours from here. A whole bunch of us were going, and I thought I'd be one of the younger people there. There were 1,000 people at this convention in the spring of 1977. And if you had divided the room in half, I would have been on the older half. That was kind of shocking, hurt my pride a little bit. One of the fellows who shared talked about developing a twitch, you know, one of these little twitchy things. And I had just developed the twitch a few days earlier, so I identified with the speaker. I was glad that there were words you could use to talk about it. And the opening night of the convention, 1,000 people, a lot came up from LA. They said, how many people are here sober tonight who are not yet of legal drinking age? And about 30 people stood up, and the place went wild. So I'm sober a year. Also, I want to mention I'm a drunk driver. And to quote my sponsor, he said, I'm Terry. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drunk driver. And then he paused for just a second, and he said, that means I was willing to kill you. And I was a drunk driver. I got my license at 16, and I think I didn't have to drink to drive like an idiot, but I drove like an idiot when I was drinking. San Jose, we'd go to Highway 17 over to Capitola and Aptos and Santa Cruz and be foolish young people and then drive home. But sober a year, and I went back to teach, and I went back to teach at Loyola High School. It was really different. And what was different is I was sober for the first time and I had no self-confidence. Now, I was a very good teacher, but it was alcohol fueled and I had no self-confidence. And I think my second year of sobriety was very difficult because I had to relearn my craft and I was not sedated all the time. And one of the things, sun is setting, one of the things that I became aware of was how frightened I was of my students. And I didn't notice that before. Rooms full of kids scared me. I had a therapist I was seeing a little bit to deal with the adjustment. And he was helpful. And he gave me a couple of clues on handling fear. Walking through the schoolyard, all these kids. Don't run through the schoolyard. Walk slowly. Look them in the face. Say hello. Maybe touch someone on their shoulder. And I found that was a way of beginning to make the adjustment, but it was really hard making that adjustment. And I went to a zillion meetings. I wrote Cardinal Manning and I said, I'm coming down to your world. And just so you know, and if there's another sober priest down there, I'd love to meet him. And he wrote me back and said, when you get to town, contact Father Terry R. So I got in on a Friday. I went to a meeting Friday night, two on Saturday, two on Sunday. And then Monday I called Terry and I said, I need a sponsor. I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know who he voted for. I didn't know what he drove. I need a sponsor. He said, when did you get to Los Angeles? I said, Friday. He said, have you been to a meeting? I said, I've been to five. He said, I'll be your sponsor. So he picked me up that night. He didn't live far, a couple of miles, which in LA is next door. And he took me to the White Flag Men's Stag, which I think is still going. And in honor of the White Flag Men's Stag, we have a little white flag just to remember that the war is over and we've lost, you know, so that's right there where I've been doing it on a regular basis. And I want to talk for just a few seconds about a universal law. And the universal law is wherever you get sober is where they do it right. And if you move anywhere, it's a crisis. Because they don't do it the same. And I know people who got sober here and moved there and didn't like it there and stopped going to meetings. It took me a year and a half to get used to Southern California style. Now, do not take this as criticism. This is just observation. A lot of people in the room, number one. Greeters at the door, terrifying. Happiness everywhere. Clapping throughout the meeting. I was so freaked out by that, all that extroverted energy. But I had to go to meetings. After a couple of months, I went to meetings pretty much in central LA. So it was Northern Watts and Southern Hollywood, which is a lot like the East Bay as far as population goes. So I finally asked my sponsor if there were any smaller meetings in Southern California because I wasn't making friends. You know, big groups of people, and how do you say hello? Terry once gave a talk on friendship in recovery, and he said, you know, when you're drinking, the terms of friendship are much clearer, you know. We're out of beer. Who will make the run? I'll make that. You are my friend, you know. Or we're out of dope. Who has more dope? I have some in the car. We're intimate best friends, but clean and sober, how do you do this thing? So, are there any small meetings in Southern California? I thought that would help me. And he said, try a big book study. They're always small. So I opened up the meeting directory, and I think in 1977, there were 1,000 meetings a week in Los Angeles. I think now there's 4,000. And there was, it was a big book study or a 12 and 12 study, step study, tradition study at a Korean church on Olympic Boulevard on Friday nights. And I started going there. Terry started going there. And I was just turned 30, and there were 12 to 18 regulars. Women and men in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, and they became my first friends over the next year or two or three. Slow, slow, slow for me. We had a thing at school where if a kid got into trouble with booze or, you know, other bad behaviors, instead of throwing them out, because I was there, we'd sentence them to AA meetings. So I was kind of out, you know, as a sober person. There were rumors about it, but we had a couple of kids who'd meet me at meetings. A couple are still sober. Oh my. In 1981, I wanted to leave teaching. I didn't like it anymore. And I remember talking to my sponsor, and the topic was, how do you make a decision? How do you make a decision? You know, what's God's will? And Terry said, it is God's will for each of us to have a life. Go get one. Which means you make decisions and live with consequences. So I said, okay, stay here, continue teaching, move to the Bay Area to do some social work. Three, run away to Scandinavia where, you know, there are never any bad problems and everything's wonderful. So the pros and cons and the pros and cons and the pros and cons, he had me write all these things down. And then we met and I thought he would analyze my homework rigorously and then make a proclamation. You know, what are sponsors for? He barely looked at the page. And I said, so what am I supposed to do next? And he said, well, you know, you could stay here in Los Angeles teaching. He said, you've done that for 4 years, clean and sober. Structure, bells ringing all day long, 10 million kids, you've been very, very busy and you've stayed sober. You can do this. Your new job in West Oakland has no structure at all. You'll be living on the street. You'll be making it up as you go along. You'll be with a lot of young people. There are no guarantees. So the question is, do you want to see if you can go to that kind of environment and see if you can stay sober? And I said, but what should I do? And he said, you could do either one. It can only be a terrible mistake. It's one of the better conversations we ever had. You can do this or you can do that. It can only be a terrible mistake. And if it's a terrible mistake, you promptly admit it and then you make the adjustments and you go do something else. It's how we learn. We learn by doing and we learn by making mistakes. And some things don't fit and with some things it's not the right time. And some things it's too early or too late. I mean, we learn. He gave me permission to take some risks and he's done that regularly over the years. So I decided to leave Los Angeles and go to Oakland. And I had that job for 3 years. It was way over my head in 100 different ways. At the end of 3 years, I knew I never wanted to do that kind of work again. And that's very important information. And then I've been doing other stuff since, but I've continued living in this part of the world. Fun plus problems, problems. Fun plus trouble. This is from the book, chapter 11. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. For most normal people, we're not prohibitionists. If you can drink, and not pee on yourself or go to jail. We're amazed. My middle brother's like this. My middle brother has an occasional beer. When he came back from Vietnam, I was drinking, and I said, Paul, can I get you something to drink? And he said, oh, no, something more to drink. And he said, oh, no, thanks, I'm starting to feel it. And I, my brother. One of the fellows here in the community has every day about five, he has one double scotch, one. And he uses a jigger, a measuring thing, which I have never seen before. I am amazed. Two quick things and then he's done. So these people exist. But not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. Fun, fun plus problems, problems. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself, as we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm. The chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. I thought I was the only one that ever did that, got the warning. I thought I was the only one that had that experience. And then Terry explained it. You know, you're out with some people and they're having a few drinks, but you're drinking. And the party's over. It's time to go home. And you're not done. And you got to go get done. And that's, there are a lot of places in Los Angeles where one could get done. And, you know, then getting home somehow and being ready to teach the next day, zowie. Hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily, we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen, a reference to the book of Revelation. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. Now, this is page 151, and it's the first page of the big book I identified with. I mean, war fever ran high in the New England town. Who cares? But this, I wasn't sure if I was an alcoholic, but I was really an unhappy drinker. I understood. To find other unhappy drinkers is a great joy. A few more things he writes, and then Bill writes in the middle of 152, we have shown how we got out from under, which is what we do. We share experience, strength, and hope. I can talk about my experience and your experience. And I was at a meeting in Michigan, sober a couple of years, and this fellow who sounded like he knew everything. You'll meet them at meetings. He explained that the first year of recovery is about physical stuff, and the second year of recovery is about emotional stuff, and the third year of recovery is about spiritual stuff. And I think I had 3 or 4 or 5 years, and that sounded right. I just want to end by saying I think the first 15 years of my recovery were physical things. You know, eat, bathe, get out of bed, exercise, get to a meeting, get some sleep. 15 years. The second 15 years, a lot of emotional stuff. Beyond the anger and the fear stuff, but grief and letting go. All that. And then understanding and connections and treating my relationship with the higher power and with other human beings and with the earth. I mean, that's what's going on these days. And I think it's good stuff. I'm very glad to be sober. I'm very glad to be alive. And we have been given a great gift, and the gift is today. And I get a daily reprieve from the worst of my crazy. And we have today. So that's everything I know on this 85th anniversary of the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. Happy birthday, hopeless alcoholics. Done.
Put me away.
Thank you so much. There at all. Oh, it's been
unmuted. He worked in it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good chair, Tom.
Here you go. Birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything in which affects you from the neck up. If you're a regular attendee of this meeting and like a take a cake, please email our scribe, Ann P, at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org. Please email us by 7:15. Otherwise, you'll have to wait until the following week to be recognized. We have several birthdays tonight. Our first birthday tonight is for Piper H for 1 year. Our second birthday is for Laura S for 1 year. We have a 2-year birthday for Jomo, who has no last name. A 4-year birthday for Billy P. We have a 12-year birthday for Therese. We have a 15-year birthday for Mason W. A 16-year birthday for Lisa C. A 21-year birthday for Linda L. A 23-year birthday for Roberta. 25-year birthday for David D. A 30-year birthday for Frank M. 32-year birthday for Paul F. Our 33-year birthday for Eddie S. 34-year birthday for Joan H. A 45-year birthday for Sharon B. A 49-year birthday for a past secretary, Rhonda D. And the biggest and best birthday of the night is an 85-year birthday for Alcoholics Anonymous. And tonight, we have a special song.
Hi, everybody. I'm Gola, and I'm an alcoholic. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear AAA. Happy birthday to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Gola. That was beautiful. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on your birthday cake. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please contact our treasurer, Betty H. Well, once again, her email address is treasurer@pacificgroupla.org. Underneath special...